Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, we all want our daughters to grow up resilient and independent.
We were told we could be anything, and we heard we have to be everything.
But how do we ensure that having it all doesn't mean doing it all? Redefining equality, that's our Inflection Point. For many of us, middle school was trial by fire, navigating relationships and self-image, not to mention grades. And if you made it through unscathed, consider yourself one of the lucky few. Today, as a society, we've become more self-aware and more equipped to help kids not only survive, but to thrive. And with the spotlight on balancing the number of women in leadership, there are now organizations focused specifically on helping girls learn critical life and leadership skills, starting as early as kindergarten. According to Girls Leadership, about 12% of the 25 million K through 12th grade girls in the United States are reached by national girl-serving organizations. But that means 22 million girls in the U.S. still aren't being reached. Simone Marian is the executive director and co-founder of Girls Leadership, which provides live programs, online content, and research to teach girls to practice healthy relationships, emotional intelligence, and assertive self-expression. Simone, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lauren. Excited to be here.
Why is it so important for there to be girl-serving organizations?
There's so many reasons why. For one, I think right now, 2015, is a moment when, on one hand, there's never been more opportunities for girls. I think many of us could argue there's never been a better time to be a girl. And with those growing opportunities are also coming growing pressures on girls. And we're seeing girls grow up in some ways in an increasingly gendered environment with increasingly gendered toys and Band-Aids and stories and clothing options and even kids' furniture saying you are a girl or you are a boy. But I think there's sometimes it feels like less and less options to be a kid. And the messages that girls are getting right now are really emphasizing their appearance above all else. And in terms of appearance, the importance of being thin and of being sexy. And girls are getting that message, according to, I think, the American Academy of Pediatrics. They're seeing 3,000 to 5,000 images a day telling them the importance of their looks and of being sexy.
Wow.
And so when girls internalize that, we see the costs. We see, as they approach adolescence, we still see a drop in girls' confidence in many areas of their lives. We're seeing that they internalize that expectation, even in early elementary school, in terms of being sexy. And that leads to a real narrowing of their interests very early on. And when it gets to adolescence, we see girls suffering from depression, stress, and anxiety at around twice the rate of boys. So we're seeing this real, not just a loss of voice, but a wellness gap in adolescence. And that stays with girls throughout their college and early career experience. And I think all of us see professionally, we still have this significant gap in the workplace where we're still, even in 2015, we're not seeing women participate, at the same level of leadership as men. And we see that really starting in kindergarten.
What are some of the other unique challenges around middle school, aside from confidence and appearance issues? Is that particular to middle school or is that also starting in kindergarten?
I have not myself taught our kindergarten program, but I taught our programs back when we were smaller and I was teaching all of our programs up until as early as second grade. And I would ask our second and third grade girls in our program, we would do this exercise called Cross the Room with their parents. And so I would ask them, cross the room if you feel pressure to be the perfect student, perfect athlete, artist, sister, friend, daughter. And I would say in my totally unscientific study that about 85% of the girls would cross the room and say, I feel this pressure to be perfect. And not surprisingly, about 85% of the parents were crossing the room at the same time. So it's not just a girl phenomenon. The girls are part of a larger cultural phenomenon. It's not ubiquitous in the United States, but in many cultures, especially middle-class affluent cultures, this culture of perfectionism is internalized very early in their social-emotional development. And definitely, I would say that pressure blossoms in middle school when girls really start to think, are taught in many ways to think in that more relational way of what, not just what do I think, what do I want to do, but what do people think of me, and do they think I'm doing things right? And as they start to care more about other people's opinions of them and care more about, invest more deeply in other people's emotions than their own emotions, that's where we really see that drop in voice and less risk-taking, not wanting to try new sports, new languages, new activities, unless they know they're going to be the best right out of the gate.
Well, also thinking about girls and young women entering college, they're vulnerable as well, right? I read in the New York Times Education Life magazine recently about their report on fear of failing contributing to undergraduate suicides every year. 1,100 young men and women every year are committing suicide as undergraduates. And what do you think is going on there? Is this all connected?
Well, I think the co-founder of Girls Leadership, Rachel Simmons, researches this college age for young women quite a bit, and she refers to what's happening with college as the college industrial complex. And I think a lot of what we see happening even in middle school is tied to that girls learning very early and hearing very early, because their parents have internalized early, this is what is needed to get into college. And it is harder than ever to get into college. The percentages are shrinking each year of the college admissions. And I think because of so many of the messages around appearance and perfectionism, I think girls are internalized this even differently than boys do. I won't say more, but I would say differently. And I know there's a researcher out of UCLA that does this college entrance survey where they ask college freshmen a series of questions. And it was her survey years ago where I first saw that rate of stress in young women at twice the rate of boys as they come into college. And when they talk to girls about why, you know, you have the same, you know, expectations in college, that for boys, they have more permission to do sports, to goof off, that yes, they had this pressure to do well, but they knew how to get rid of that stress, whereas the girls in their free time were volunteering and still trying to keep on the resume track for getting out of college. So there wasn't the same permission for girls with their behaviors to deal with stress as there was for the boys.
And do you think that's self-inflicted, or do you think that's, again, going back to the parents and their expectations around what their girls should and can be doing?
I think a lot of these behaviors come from very deep gender bias. And there was a study that came out of Harvard School of Education from their group called Making Caring Common that looked at unconscious bias in students. And what they found was that girls had bias against other girls in leadership. So we've known for years in the women's leadership field that there was unconscious bias in the workplace. But we're seeing that unconscious bias is there early, and they also looked at parents. This was a big study. I think there were 20,000 participants or something. And the parents also they discovered this unconscious bias in the home. They didn't have numbers to report on the dads, but they did investigate enough with them. They had a big enough pool of moms to get data on the moms, and they found that moms had unconscious bias towards boys in leadership, that they were promoting their boys more for leadership positions and were more uncomfortable with girls in leadership. And so I think as we look at what's happening in the home and what's happening in grade school, we just see, you know, I think we thought that many years ago that this was external. If we changed the policies, if we opened up doors to women, that the external experiences were to be available, that we would suddenly move into these new external roles. And I think what we're seeing, you know, Rachel talked years ago about girls having an internal glass ceiling. And to me, this unconscious bias study from Harvard shows that that's there, and it's there in the home. And how do you become aware of unconscious bias, and how do you address it? Like, that's a huge question. And I think that's hard and puts most of us in an uncomfortable situation because we don't think we have bias.
Because it's unconscious,
right?
But it seems like unconscious bias is coming up in a lot of different ways, in race well and other ways. And maybe the more you talk about it, the more conscious you become of it.
Yes. Well, that was part of the study, was saying when students are aware, when they're taught they have unconscious bias, they do start to address it. So I think that's part of it. And then I think it's one of the things that we're thinking about is this organization focused on not, you know, all 25 million girls in the U.S. is, you know, how do we educate parents? How do we send? We all know how busy we are. We all know the pressure on parents. So how do we communicate in a small enough, frequent enough way so that we can help folks become aware of what they're doing and then try to change habits, try to look at what are the books on your child's shelf? You know, when are you saying good boy versus good girl? What are you praising? What qualities are you praising? I think it's going to be like micro-education.
Well, and it also feels so complicated. You know, as a parent, I wonder how we balance encouraging our girls to succeed. You know, how do we not overcompensate for this unconscious bias even, but without the inherent flip side of, you know, if you fail, that's bad. You know, encouraging them to succeed, but without the flip side of it of failure.
Right. Well, I think some of the ways that we talk about that at Girls Leadership is we really try not to talk about success, because so often success is externally driven. How do other people define success? And I think what we really want to teach girls, and this goes back to sort of our definition of leadership, which is very, traditional definitions of leadership are very about success, right? About external, what's your paycheck, what's your rank? And we really see leadership as starting internally with how do girls think, how do they feel, and then how do they become aware and respect their own thoughts and feelings. And so part of what we're trying to do in our very personal and interpersonal curriculum is help girls fail, that we want them to not go after success, but to go after being able to try new things, make mistakes, figure out, did they enjoy trying that new thing? Was that fun? Was that for their college resume? Or was that a really good time? You know, did time disappear? Well, if time disappeared, go back and do it again, because that's awesome. That's like a sign that that's something that you love. So we're trying to, I think, get girls off of that external success track.
Your organization and you have talked about raising resilient girls. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I think it ties back to sort of what I'm talking about with failure, right? This isn't all-star girls. We're not trying to put more pressure on girls, right? Courtney Martin has a great quote in her book, Perfect Girls, Starving Daughters, where she says, we were told we could be anything, and we heard we have to be everything. Mm. And I think for many of us who are parents right now, that resonates.
Yes.
And so, right, it's how do we now tell our girls, You can be anything without that pressure of everything. And I think that's hard to do as a parent, given the college expectations, given how much harder it is for our kids to have the experience that we had. You know, it's what's asked of them now is different than when we were their age. And so I think that's challenging. And so I think if we're not asking them to check off boxes for the all-star college resume, then it's really resilience is what we aspire to, because that to me is about the cycle of risk taking, right? That's about what do I want to try? How do I think about going after that? There's the little moment that's the action itself, right? Whether that's soccer or cooking or asking a new friend to do something with you. And then there's the process of how do you recover from that, whether it went well or it went badly, how do you come back to the next risk? And I think we just want girls to be able to go through that cycle constantly and not narrow themselves into only doing those things that make other people happy or keep them, you know, going on down the success track again for others and becoming increasingly detached from what they think and feel.
Well, does that tie into this other area that you talk about, which is self-compassion? And how that's different from self-esteem. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah,
more?
Self-compassion is a really important part of that cycle. You know, it is that moment of recovery afterwards, especially if something wasn't done perfectly. And, you know, it really intersects with Carol Dweck's work out of Stanford and growth mindset, right? Carol Dweck did a study years ago where it looked at how our boys and girls parented, and specifically how are they praised from ages 0 to 3. And what she saw was that boys tended to be praised more for their effort, and girls tended to be praised more for their talent. And what that led to, she did a 5-year follow-up, those that were praised more for their talent became risk-averse, more risk-averse than those that were praised for their effort. because those praised for their effort develop what Carol Dweck calls growth mindset. The harder I work, the more I practice, the better I'll get. And I think when girls grow up in a society that, or a culture that is teaching them fixed mindset, they're growing up, I'm either an all-star at something, I'm naturally gifted, I'm naturally talented, or I'm not. And that keeps them from taking risks. So part of helping them develop this growth mindset is teaching them very early, and we've got that 0 to 3, right, that it's about effort, and it's about repetition, and it's about practice. And then when something doesn't go perfectly, which it's guaranteed to happen, especially when they're new at something, then that's when we want them to practice that self-compassion, to recognize that they tried, that they are in good company of many other people who were not perfect at this the first time that they tried something, and really be kind to themselves and not go to that shame place. We talk a lot at Girls Leadership about how shame, when girls internalize their mistakes and they think, oh, I didn't just have a bad basketball practice or a bad test today, I'm a bad person, right? And when they feel ashamed, that really holds them back from trying again or trying better. And instead, if we can have them recognize, it's not about me, that's how I did at that test. This was an action. This was a behavior. Then it's much easier to address and change the behavior.
And is that something that parents can do, is reinforce that new way of thinking about it? It's not you. It was that one moment. It was that one test.
Yes. And I think one of the things that parents can do is actually also look at how we as parents talk about ourselves, right? So when you mess up, whether it's at home or at work or with friends, are you going to that place of like, I am such an idiot, I'm a bad person, I'm bad at my job, versus, you know, I made a mistake today? And how, you know, kids get their scripts from us, right? So we have both a challenge and an opportunity to look at how are we talking about ourselves in front of them, and to share our mistakes with them. That I think I often joke with parents that if we make mistakes during our day and we don't share it with our kids, we're not doing them any favors. Like, our girls especially really need to hear our stories of messing up. And when they do, we can role model for them that we're not ashamed, we're not bad people, we're not like going and hiding in a cave. We just could have done that better, and that's what we'll go do next week or tomorrow whenever we're ready.
What about this idea of intrinsic motivation? You mentioned Rachel Simmons, your co-founder. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on what intrinsic motivation means?
Yeah, I think I really see intrinsic motivation as it's like a self-perpetuating cycle, right? Is the motivation coming from outside, or is it internal? And I think when girls become perfectionistic, when they buy into this expectation that this Girls Inc. study called it super girls, right, where they really think, I am supposed to be a super girl. I'm supposed to be an extraordinary girl in order to succeed in life. I have to be in the top, you know, 10% of girls or youth. And it's not just in terms of academics, it's also in terms of looks and friends and clothes and, right, all that stuff that's being sold to them. When that is externally driven rather than intrinsic, they can, quote, fail by somebody giving them a bad grade, right? So they get a B, or their friend doesn't like their outfit, or somebody looks at them and they're not sexy enough. Then their whole sense of value can crumble. Versus if their experience is they are intrinsically motivated, it's about how did that feel?
So what was your journey to running Girls Leadership?
My journey began about 15 years ago when I met Rachel Simmons, the co-founder at our summer program. And I really came to this, I'm embarrassed to say, I did not identify as a leader. I didn't aspire to leadership. And I was working with her as a teaching artist. So I was there to teach theater. I was getting my degree in education from NYU. And I really brought to this work my own cultural background, which is what I would consider like stereotypical New England communication habits and lack of conflict negotiation abilities, that I really grew up trying to avoid conflict and trying to be fine. And so when I started working with Rachel, I was there to teach theater and build community. And she was teaching a class one day called How to Have a Conflict. And I thought that was so weird because I thought, we're not supposed to have conflicts. Why are we teaching these girls how to have conflicts? And what I found is I was taking copious notes because this sounded awesome. I wanted to have a conflict. You know, this was really about this whole part of my voice that I thought I wasn't supposed to have. And it sounded really thrilling to be able to speak up in this way that was not necessarily in agreement with somebody. And then I did what most of us do with notes. I shoved them in a drawer for a year until I needed to have a conflict. I was working as an independent contractor, and at sort of the last moment, a program that I was supposed to teach was canceled. And at first I went with my 25 years of socialization response, and I said, fine, thank you. Thanks for letting me know. And I went back to my apartment, and I thought, I'm not fine. I was expecting these months of compensation. How am I going to pay my rent? And I thought, I need to speak up. And I remembered I had notes on how to speak up. And so I went and I took out my notes and I filled out this sheet of paper and four steps. And I was so scared and to go back to this administrator who canceled the program. And my face was red and I remember my heart beating in my chest. And I went through these steps of speaking up and saying, I enjoy this work. I find it very rewarding. And I acknowledge my contribution. I said, I know we don't have anything in writing. We didn't have a contract. I should have asked for that. And then I did the part that was most terrifying for me. I asked her for what I needed. I said, I think it's fair that I be compensated. And I think I started by saying, for some of this time, like softening the ask. And I was so shocked that there was sort of two parts of her response that I was not expecting. One was saying that I was right, that I did deserve to be compensated the full amount for the work that had been promised to me. And then I thought, okay, I'll get this money, but then I'll be that difficult teacher that nobody wants to work with, and that'll be the end. And she followed up on that by saying, and, you know, will you come work for us in the fall? Will you come run our after-school program? We really enjoy working with you. And I thought, wait, what? There's a future to this relationship? Like, there's you know, this isn't the end. And so for me, that was definitely a light bulb moment where it was like, I could ask, and I had never asked. And I think that was the beginning of me communicating differently with my friends and with my family. And I've definitely become a more difficult person.
But that's a good thing,
it's
right?
It's a good thing. And I wouldn't go back because, I mean, I always think when I'm asked that question, I think of the countless conversations that creating and practicing and teaching this curriculum has given me with my family, with my friends over the last 15 years. And those conversations I wouldn't have had if I didn't have a curriculum teaching me something different.
Well, do you think we need a boys' leadership organization?
Yes. Yes, we desperately need a boys' leadership organization. Probably the most popular question I get right now is, what about the boys? And as the mother of two boys, it's an important question. It's a, you know, and I think when I look at the violence that boys are perpetuating in our society right now, when I look at what's happening with the college applications and the wellness on campuses, it's clear that boys need these social and emotional tools just as much as the girls do. And I know we're not the best people to teach them. That's not our expertise. That's not our mission. We would be doing boys a disservice if we tried to become boys leadership. But we are always looking for folks working in the boys space to support and to celebrate their work, because this is so important that boys have these skills as well. It's important for the boys. It's important for the girls that they have partners with these skills, both professionally or personally.
Simone, what's the best advice about leadership you've ever received?
Oh, I would say the best advice that I have received hasn't come from a particular individual, but from more of the design thinking and collaborative approach that I have learned over the last, I think, several years, and seems to be having sort of a renaissance, at least in Silicon Valley. And that idea that all of us are smarter than any of us. And I think for so many years, I equated leadership with this being a superstar human being, or being like beyond smart, that you had to be the smartest one in the room. And I think as a young person growing up with a learning difference, I never considered myself to be the smartest one in the room. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't identify as a leader. And I think as I've really learned to collaborate and learn to listen and dialogue with other people, I feel like my understanding of leadership has changed, and now I really see it as the person who can bring together the best that other people have to offer and combine those and really respond to different ideas. And part of that authentic listening, I think, comes from just being true to yourself, that this isn't about putting on a suit or giving a talk or being some external idea. A bunch of middle school girls once told me that leaders meant wearing really boring shoes. So I have this vision of leadership that's like the decorated Converse, that you can be yourself. And in fact, if you're not yourself, you can't really listen and engage. And so it's really coming to that place of authenticity and comfort with yourself enough that you can listen and engage with other people.
And show up wearing your decorated Converse.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I don't have to wear the boring shoes.
I love it.
Well, Simone Marien, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate it very much. Not necessarily in agreement with somebody. And then I did what most of us do with notes. I shoved them in a drawer for a year until I needed to have a conflict. I was working as an independent contractor, and at sort of the last moment, a program that I was supposed to teach was canceled. And at first I went with my 25 years of socialization response. And I said, fine, thank you. Thanks for letting me know. And I went back to my apartment and I thought, I'm not fine. I was expecting these months of compensation. How am I going to pay my rent? And I thought, I need to speak up. And I remembered I had notes on how to speak up. And so I went and I took out my notes and I filled out this sheet of paper and four steps. And I was so scared and to go back to this administrator who canceled the program. And my face was red and I could remember my heart beating in my chest. And I went through these steps of speaking up and saying, I enjoy this work. I find it very rewarding. And I acknowledge my contribution. I said, I know we don't have anything in writing. We didn't have a contract. I should have asked for that. And then I did the part that was most terrifying for me. I asked her for what I needed. I said, I think it's fair that I be compensated. And I think I started by saying, for some of this time, like softening the ask. And I was so shocked that there was sort of two parts of her response that I was not expecting. One was saying that I was right, that I did deserve to be compensated the full amount for the work that had been promised to me. And then I thought, okay, I'll get this money, but then I'll be that difficult teacher that nobody wants to work with, and that'll be the end. And she followed up on that by saying, and, you know, will you come work for us in the fall? Will you come run our after-school program? We really enjoy working with you. And I thought, wait, what? There's a future to this relationship? Like, there's, you know, this isn't the end. And so for me, that was definitely a light bulb moment where it was like, I could ask. And I had never asked. And I think that was the beginning of me communicating differently with my friends and with my family. And I've definitely become a more difficult person.
But that's a good thing,
right?
It's
a good thing. And I wouldn't go back because, I mean, I always think when I'm asked that question, I think of the countless conversations that creating and practicing and teaching this curriculum has given me with my family, with my friends over the last 15 years. And those conversations I wouldn't have had if I didn't have a curriculum teaching me something different.
Well, do you think we need a boys' leadership organization?
Yes. Yes, we desperately need a boys' leadership organization. Probably the most popular question I get right now is, what about the boys? And as the mother of two boys, it's an important question. It's a, you know, and I think when I look at the violence that boys are perpetuating in our society right now, when I look at what's happening with the college applications and the wellness on campuses, it's clear that boys need these social and emotional tools just as much as the girls do. And I know we're not the best people to teach them. That's not our expertise. That's not our mission. We would be doing boys a disservice if we tried to become boys leadership. But we are always looking for folks working in the boys' space to support and to celebrate their work, because this is so important that boys have these skills as well. It's important for the boys. It's important for the girls that they have partners with these skills, both professionally or personally.
Simone, what's the best advice about leadership you've ever received?
Oh, I would say the best advice that I have received hasn't come from a particular individual, but from more of the design thinking and collaborative approach that I have learned over the last, I think, several years, and seems to be having sort of a renaissance, at least in Silicon Valley. And that idea that all of us are smarter than any of us. And I think for so many years, I equated one of the, like, leadership with this being a superstar human being or being, like, beyond smart, that you had to be the smartest one in the room. And I think as a young person growing up with a learning difference, I never considered myself to be the smartest one in the room. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't identify as a leader. And I think as I've really learned to collaborate and learn to listen and dialogue with other people, I feel like my understanding of leadership has changed. And now I really see it as the person who can bring together the best that other people have to offer and combine those and really respond to different ideas. And part of that authentic listening, I think, comes from just being true to yourself, that this isn't about putting on a suit or giving a talk or being some external idea. A bunch of middle school girls once told me that leaders meant wearing really boring shoes. So I have okay. this vision of leadership that's like the decorated Converse, that you can be yourself. And in fact, if you're not yourself, you can't really listen and engage. And so it's really coming to that place of authenticity and comfort with yourself enough that you can listen and engage with other people.
And show up wearing your decorated Converse.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I don't have to wear the boring shoes.
Love it.
Well, Simone Marien, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate it very much.
That was Simone Marien, the executive director and co-founder of Girls Leadership. I'm Lauren Schiller, and you're listening to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. We all want our daughters to grow up resilient and independent. But how do we ensure that having it all doesn't mean doing it all?
Then men's roles really have to change. They have to be caregivers as well as breadwinners.
For more about women in leadership, be sure to listen to our conversation with Anne Marie Slaughter, whose book Unfinished Business is out now. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.